Chapter 2. A Storm of Swords. From the Beginning to the Harrenhal Bath. 1. The initial antagonism on both of their parts and how it influences their relationship. One thing that's fundamental to point out when it comes to how Jaime and Brienne relate to each other is that they don't initially like each other. She's convinced he's an honorless oathbreaker, and he reacts likewise, mocking her appearance and her supposed skills. Now, on his side, Jaime is the kind of person who tends to respect people in his trade of work, so it's likely that if they met in a neutral situation, like a tourney, he'd have most likely been fascinated by her skills. This, when throughout his first few A Storm of Swords chapters, he can't help making remarks all the time about how she's dull or ugly, but admires her competence regardless of himself. On Brienne's side, given her character evolution up to that point, she would have automatically been antagonistic. Instead, because for everything she knows, he's in the Kingsguard without deserving, and stayed in the Kingsguard after breaking his most sacred oath. So he's, without deserving, in a place where she would do anything to be, when she knows she has the skills for it, and the attitude as far as she's concerned. So it's just a reminder that as good as she is, she'll never have the chance at it, while he does. And like, that's the crux of it. I.e., there's way more antagonism on her part than his own. So their initial dislike matches. She thinks he's a horrible person, but she will keep him alive because she swore an oath to her lady. And he thinks she's playing at being knights, even if something suggests to him she's better than that. And they antagonize each other all the time. This is actually a fundamental thing in the evolution of their relationship, because it means they have to put effort in understanding each other and learning from each other. And it's already an opposite starting point from Jaime and Cersei's, where the two of them never actually thought to disagree because they're supposed to be the same person. This is also fundamental to Brienne's character development, as when they meet, Brienne's still pretty judgmental. And through meeting Jaime, she eventually realizes that the world isn't so black and white as she thinks it is, and that vows aren't the beginning and end of everything, and you can't presume to uphold all of them, especially if you're working for someone like Aerys. On the other side, Jaime is presented with someone who, regardless of being hindered by every possible thing when it comes to their trade, her gender, her status, and her looks, is determined to be a good, true knight at all costs and actually means it. So he finally sees that actually there is someone who can and will do it at all costs, differently from what he has come to assume since he killed Aerys. The thing is, she embodies what he would have wanted to be, and he gets that after he gets past his preconceptions. But on the other side, the fact that he's her prisoner and technically under her protection establishes a reverse knight-lady dynamic, which is fundamental to their balance. Because the fact that he eventually comes to see her as his knight, this will be thoroughly discussed later, is also one of the reasons why he actually opens up to her about Aerys, when he never did with anyone else before, and trusts her that much regardless of whether he knows that, consciously or not. 2. The fight in the woods. One pivotal moment of their time together is when, after already having traveled for a while and traded insults all along, things come to a heated conclusion in between them, and they fight each other before being captured by the Bloody Mummers. It's extremely important, not only because it's the last time Jaime gets to fight someone with his dominant hand, but also because it's when he truly begins to see how Brienne is really not playing around, and actually has skills. Grunting, she came at him, blade whirling, and suddenly it was Jaime struggling to keep steel from skin, One of her slashes raked across his brow, and blood ran down into his right eye. The others take her, and River Run as well. His skills had gone to rust and rot in that bloody dungeon, and the chains were no great help either. His eye closed, his shoulders were going numb from the jarring they'd taken, and his wrists ached from the weight of the chains, manacles, and sword. His longsword grew heavier with each blow, and Jamie knew he was not swinging it as quickly as he'd done earlier, nor raising it as high. "She's stronger than I am." The realization chilled him. Robert had been stronger than him, to be sure. The White Bull, Gerald Hightower, was as well, in his heyday, and Sir Arthur Dayne. Amongst the living, Great John Umber was stronger. Strong boar of Krakenhall, most likely. Both Clegane's for a certainty. The mountain strength was like nothing human. It did not matter. With speed and skill, Jamie could beat them all. But this was a woman. A huge cow of a woman, to be sure. But even so, by rights, she should be the one wearing down. Previously, Jamie had grudgingly admitted to himself that she was more capable than she seemed. But here is when he realizes that she's actually his peer when it comes to skills. And actually that she might be even better than he is. And given that he puts a lot of stakes on his prowess in a fight, of course he does. It's his trade. At this point, he has to recognize her as someone on his level, if not higher. Before then, though, he was enjoying it. And if reading the entire context, the scene takes on different connotations. Jamie could not have said how long he pressed the attack. It might have been minutes, or it might have been hours. Time slept when swords woke. He drove her away from his cousin's corpse, drove her across the road, drove her into the trees. She stumbled once on a route she never saw, and for a moment he thought she was done. But she went down to one knee instead of falling, and never lost a beat. Her sword leapt up to block a down cut that would have opened her from shoulder to groin. And then she cut at him again and again, fighting her way back to her feet stroke by stroke. The dance went on. He pinned her against an oak, cursed as she slipped away, followed her through a shallow brook, half choked with fallen leaves. Steel rang, steel rang, steel screamed and sparked and scraped. And the woman started grunting like a sow at every crash. Yet, somehow, he could not reach her. It was as if she had an iron cage around her that stopped every blow. "Not bad at all," he said, when he paused for a second to catch his breath, circling to her right. "For a wench?" "For a squire, say. A green one." He laughed, a ragged, breathless laugh. "Come on, come on, my sweetling. The music's still playing. Might I have this dance, my lady?" First, the fight is described as a dance, and he goes to the point of asking her outright. And that's usually more of a romantic come on than one you'd use in a fight. Of course, he's mocking her by calling her sweetling or my lady, but he still does. And this is right before he realizes she's actually his match. This doesn't change before they actually meet the Bloody Mummers. A slick stone turned under Jamie's foot. As he felt himself falling, he twisted the mischance into a diving lunge. His point scraped past her parry and bit into her upper thigh. A red flower blossomed, and Jamie had an instant to savor the sight of her blood. Before his knee slammed into a rock. The pain was blinding. Brienne splashed into him and kicked away his sword. Jamie drove his shoulder into her legs, bringing her down on top of him. They rolled, kicking and punching until finally she was sitting astride him. He managed to jerk her dagger from its sheath, but before he could plunge it into her belly, she caught his wrist and slammed his hands back on a rock so hard he thought she'd wrenched an arm from its socket. Her other hand spread across his face. "Yield!" She shoved his head down, held it under, pulled it back up. "Yield!" Jamie spat water into her face. A shove, a splash, and he was under again, kicking uselessly, fighting to breathe. Up again. "Yield or I'll drown you!" "And break your oath?" he snarled. "Like me?" And the woods rang with coarse laughter. Brienne lurched to her feet. She was all mud and blood below the waist, her clothing askew, her face red. "She looks as if they caught us fucking instead of fighting." Jamie crawled over the rocks to shallow water, wiping the blood from his eye with his chained hands. Armed men lined both sides of the brook. Small wonder, we were making enough noise to wake a dragon. "Well met, friends," he called to them amiably. "My pardons if I disturbed you. You caught me chastising my wife."
"Seemed to me she was doing the chastising."
The man who spoke was thick and powerful, and the nasal bar of his iron half-helm did not wholly conceal his lack of nose. The end of this fight is full of symbolism that verges on full romantic implications. First, there's the dance, but then there's the red flower blossoming on her thigh, which is where blood could be most likely found after losing one's virginity. Then they fight each other, with her pretty much coming out on top, and Jamie throwing back in her face that she'd break her oath same as he did if she killed him, which is immensely important, as that at the end of her Feast for Crows chapters, she refuses to kill him when Catelyn turned Lady Stoneheart, says it's what she has to do to keep it. And he's the one thinking that they look like they've been caught fucking, and tells the bandits that he was chastising his wife. And actually, one of them replies that she seemed to be chastising him, which, given their positions right now, he's her captor and she's his jailer, but she's also supposed to protect him and keep him safe until they get to King's Landing, already sets them up as possible partners in more than one sense. If it wasn't meant to be in the text, we wouldn't have had a scene full of sexual connotation / innuendo, where the fight starts like a dancing proposal, and he recognizes her not just as his peer, but as someone who's better than him at this trade. Of course, at this point, they're still pretty much enemies, but this greatly changes when they get captured by the Bloody Mummers and have to actually stick up for each other in order to survive. 3. Captivity with the Bloody Mummers and Jaime's maiming. What happens just after then is that the Bloody Mummers cut off Jaime's right hand in order to make sure he doesn't try to escape, and for insurance. And from then on, he spends his time until Harrenhal dealing with the loss of his hand, crippling fever, and being pretty much powerless and fighting suicidal instincts. This, while the Mummers keep on being a continuous threat to both of them. This is a turning point in Jaime's character evolution for bad and for good, because he has taken forcefully from him a part of him that is fundamental to his trade and livelihood, and he gets to the brink of death, from which Brienne saves him more than once. Now, throughout their imprisonment, Brienne actually acts as his only lifesaver, and she's literally what keeps him alive in more than one way. This when she's not even supposed to like him. They both don't like each other and got captured while fighting the hell out of each other. This is made clear from the very beginning of how their situation is described, just after the hand loss. He had taken wounds before, but never like this. He had never known they could be such pain. Sometimes, unbidden, old prayers bubbled from his lips. Prayers he learned as a child and never thought of since. Prayers he had first prayed with Cersei kneeling beside him in the Sept at Casterly Rock. Sometimes he even wept until he heard the Mummers laughing. Then he made his eyes go dry and his heart go dead and prayed for his fever to burn away his tears. Now I know how Tyrion has felt all those times they laughed at him. After the second time he fell from the saddle, they bound him tight to Brienne of Tarth and made them share a horse again. One day, instead of back to front, they bound them face to face. "The lovers," Shagwell sighed loudly. "And what a lovely sight they are. 'Twould be cruel to separate the good knight and his lady." Then he laughed that high, shrill laugh of his and said, "Ah, but which one is the knight and which one is the lady?" "If I had my hand, you'd learn soon enough," Jamie thought. His arms ached and his legs were numb from the ropes. But after a while, none of that mattered. His world shrunk to the throb of agony that was his phantom hand, and Brienne pressed against him. "She's warm, at least," he consoled himself, though the wench's breath was as foul as his own. Just the fact that the mummer's jester goes and straight up calls them lovers and asks who out of them is the knight or the lady is a textual hint of the role reversal going on with the two of them. Of course, Shagwell says it to make fun of them, but as we've seen, since it's actually textual that she is the knight-coded one and he is the lady-coded one in their partnership, and that's how it stays for them most of the time, it's not such a subtle hint of what's going on here. Also, he notices that she's warm, and she's pretty much his only source of comfort in this scenario. But then it goes way beyond that. His throat was so raw that he could not eat. But he drank wine when they gave it to him, and water when that was all they offered. Once they handed him a cup, and he quaffed it straight away, trembling, and the brave companions burst into laughter so loud and harsh it hurt his ears. "That's horse piss you're drinking, Kingslayer," Rorge told him. Jaime was so thirsty he drank it anyway. But afterwards, he retched it all back up. They made Brienne wash the vomit out of his beard, just as they made her clean him up when he soiled himself in the saddle. Ellipses. Shagwell came hopping from leg to leg, dancing nimbly aside when Jaime slashed at him. Unbalanced, he staggered forward, hacking wildly at the fool. But Shagwell spun and ducked and darted until all the mummers were laughing at Jamie's futile attempts to land a blow. When he tripped over a rock and stumbled to his knees, the fool leapt in and planted a wet kiss atop his head. Brienne isn't just his source of heat or moderate consolation. Brienne is literally in charge of keeping him somewhat presentable, and she performs extremely intimate tasks with him, such as cleaning him up, whether it's vomit or excrements, which is most likely not what she thinks she has signed up for, and something that, in usual situations, would require a great deal of trust on both parts. Of course, here they're thrown into it, so it's no usual situation. But she doesn't refuse it, and he doesn't remark on feeling humiliated because of that, more because of his lack of hand. And she's willing to do that for him when she barely even knows him. She doesn't seem to regret it or remember it with negativity in her chapters in the following book, as we'll see later. So we can assume she doesn't see it as a weakness or something she eventually loathed doing. Also, she's not present in the paragraph concerning Shagwell's extremely unsettling behavior with him. But since, in the following book, she kills him and another of the mummers, while also thinking of what he did to Jaime, we can assume that she was very much paying attention and not liking one bit what the mummers were doing. That doesn't take into account when she pretty much convinces him not to let himself die. Jaime lay on his back afterward, staring at the night sky, trying not to feel the pain that snaked up his right arm every time he moved it. The night was strangely beautiful. The moon was a graceful crescent, and it seemed as though he had never seen so many stars. The king's crown was at the zenith, and he could see the stallion rearing, and there was the swan. The moon maid, shy as ever, was half hidden behind a pine tree. "How can such a night be beautiful?" he asked himself. "Why would the stars want to look down on such as me?" "Jaime," Brienne whispered, so faintly he thought he was dreaming it. "Jaime, what are you doing?" "Dying, he whispered back. No, she said. No, you must live.
He wanted to laugh. Stop telling me what to do, wench. I'll die if it pleases me.
Are you so craven?
The word shocked him. He was Jaime Lannister, a knight of the Kingsguard. He was the Kingslayer. No man had ever called him craven. Other things they called him, yes. Oathbreaker, liar, murderer. They said he was cruel, treacherous, reckless, but never craven. What else can I do but die?
Live, she said. Live and fight and take revenge.
But she spoke too loudly. Rorge heard her voice, if not her words, and came over to kick her, shouting at her to hold her bloody tongue if she wanted to keep it. Craven, Jaime thought, as Brienne fought to stifle her moans. Can it be? They took my sword hand. Was that all I was, a sword hand? Gods be good, is it true? At this point, again, she isn't even supposed to like him, but she still encourages him not to give up and to take revenge on them by going on living. She definitely learned enough about him at this point to know that accusing him of being a coward would do the job. And she's also using his name rather than Kingslayer, which she's done until now. This suggests that she doesn't see him as just that anymore. And she's pretty much the reason why he actually doesn't give up on himself and keeps on living. This already establishes that by now they have a bond/connection, regardless of whether they like it or not, because no one comes out of this kind of situation after having stuck up for each other without it. And we can see it also on his side later when he saves her from being raped. That's also an extremely important part of their relationship and of his character, and it plays a very large role in how she changes her opinion of him later. Before he got maimed, he actually did warn her about it, and did try to make sure she wouldn't be harmed, even if he technically had no reason to.
I hope you're pleased, wench, Jaime whispered at Brienne.
He coughed and spat out a mouthful of blood. If you'd armed me, we'd never have been taken. She made no answer. There's a pig, stubborn bitch, he thought. But brave, yes, he could not take that from her. When we make camp for the night, you'll be raped, and more than once, he warned her. You'd be wise not to resist. If you fight them, you'll lose more than a few teeth. He felt Brienne's back stiffen against his.
Is that what you would do? If you were a woman?
If I were a woman, I'd be Cersei. If I were a woman, I'd make them kill me, but I'm not. Jaime kicked their horse into a trot. Urswick, a word.
Ellipses.
Jaime gave Urswick a knowing smile. All the gold in Casterly Rock. Why let the goat enjoy it? Why not take us to King's Landing and collect my ransom for yourself? Hers as well, if you like. Tarth is called the Sapphire Isle, a maiden told me once. The wench squirmed at that, but said nothing. Ares, Jaime thought resentfully. It always turns on Ares. He swayed with the motion of his horse, wishing for a sword. Two swords would be even better, one for the wench and one for me. We'd die, but we'd take half of them down to hell with us.
Why did you tell him Tarth was the Sapphire Isle? Brienne whispered when Urswick was out of earshot. He's like to think my father's rich in gemstones.
You'd best pray he does. At this point, he's actually blaming her for their capture, but he still tries to find a way to make sure she isn't harmed. We already know that Jaime does feel fairly strongly about the subject, as that he hated he couldn't do anything to save Rayla from Ares back in the day. And he's entirely aware of what harm it would do her, to the point where he says that if he was a woman, he'd rather die than letting it happen to him. Of course, his attempt to get the mummers to turn on each other doesn't work, and he loses the hand, and the topic is brought back up after he does.
It was the next night when they finally came. Three of the worst. Shagwell, Noseless Rorge, and the fat Dothraki Zolo, the one who'd cut his hand off. Zolo and Rorge were arguing about who would go first as they approached. There seemed to be no question, but that the fool would be going last. Shagwell suggested they should both go first and take her front and rear. Rolo and Rorge liked that notion, only then they began to fight about who would get the front and who the rear. They will leave her a cripple, too, but inside, where it does not show. "Wench," he whispered, as Rolo and Rorge were cursing one another. "Let them have the meat and you go far away. It will be over quicker and they'll get less pleasure from it." "They'll get no pleasure from what I'll give them," she whispered back, defiant. Stupid, stubborn, brave bitch. She was going to get herself good and killed. He knew it. And what do I care if she does? If she hadn't been so pig-headed, I'd still have a hand. Yet he heard himself whisper, "Let them do it and go away inside." That was what he'd done when the Starks had died before him. Lord Rickard cooking in his armor, while his son, Brandon, strangled himself trying to save him. Think of Renly if you loved him. Think of Tarth, mountains and seas, pools, waterfalls, whatever you have on your Sapphire Isle. Think. But Rorge had won the argument by then.
"You're the ugliest woman I ever seen," he told Brienne. "But don't think I can't make you uglier. You want a nose like mine? Fight me and you'll get one. And two eyes, that's too many. One scream out of you and I'll pop one out and make you eat it. And then I'll pull your fucking teeth out one by one."
"Oh, do it, Rorge," pleaded Shagwell. "Without her teeth, she'll look just like my dear old mother," he cackled. "And I always wanted to fuck my dear old mother up the arse."
Jamie chuckled. "There's a funny fool. I have a riddle for you, Shagwell. Why do you care if she screams? Oh, wait, I know," he shouted. "Sapphires!" as loudly as he could. Cursing, Rorge kicked at his stump again. Jamie howled.
"I never knew there was such agony in the world," was the last thing he remembered thinking.
It was hard to say how long he was gone, but when the pain spit him out, Urswick was there and Vargo Hoat himself.
"These not to be touched!" the goat screamed, spraying spittle all over Zolo. "Thee has to be a maid, you fools! Thee's worth a bag of sapphires!"
And from then on, every night Hope put guards on them to protect them from his own. Two nights passed in silence before the wench finally found the courage to whisper, "Jamie, why did you shout out?"
"Why did I shout out sapphires, you mean? Use your wits, wench. Would this lot have cared if I shouted rape?"
"You did not need to shout at all. You're hard enough to look at with a nose. Besides, I wanted to make the goat say sapphires." He chuckled. "A good thing for you, I'm such a liar. An honorable man would have told the truth about the Sapphire Isle."
"All the same," she said, "I thank you, sir."
At this point, while he still wants to tell himself that he blames her for his current situation, he gives her genuine, for him, advice on how best to deal with it, which is actually telling in itself because he explains to her how to go away inside, which is actually straight up dissociating, which in itself is one of the most common coping techniques people suffering from PTSD use, especially military veterans, which only makes sense as we're talking about someone who has been in a war slash in an extremely traumatic, violent situation at 15 to 17. And what Jamie does every time he has the chance. Of course, Brienne hears none of that and is intending to fight, and he calls her a stupid bitch, but also stubborn and brave in the same sentence, as if he admires her for it. And he can't hate her for rejecting his, for him, extremely good advice. And when he sees that there is no way she will let it happen,
He makes his chief captor aware of the other's intentions by shouting out that if she's touched, they won't get their supposed sapphires anymore, at the price of extreme physical pain. He gets kicked in the healing stump. On Hearth's side, Brienne is so shocked by the fact that he saved her and put himself on the line for her that it takes her days to talk to him about it. And she wants to know why he felt the need to when he didn't need to, and no one else might have done it for her. When she thanks him, she calls him Sir for the first time, using full-on courtesy, which suggests she has already started to think of him as not the monster she once thought of. Then he spins it as a way of paying back his debts to her. But he wasn't thinking that when he saved her, and he knows that perfectly. To sum it up, their time as prisoners has brought them to actually stick up for each other and brought down their antagonism. Brienne has seen him at his lowest and had to perform extremely intimate labor for him and has literally kept him alive by convincing him not to let himself die. He's shared with her something he hasn't with anyone up until now, and he has risked his neck to save her from being raped, something that he would rather die than be subjected to. And this is what allows them to have their conversation in Harrenhal's tub, which is the turning point of their relationship. The last interesting thing to note, before moving on to that, though, is how Jaime describes her at the end of the Storm of Swords chapter in question, when he's asked what she is to him. "This wench is bigger than me and uglier than you. You'd best see to her as well. She's still limping on the leg I pricked when we fought." "I will ask after her. What is this woman to you?" "My protector." Jaime had to laugh, no matter how it hurt. Now here he's asking the local Maester Qyburn to look after her as well, because she might need medical attention, even if less than him. And so he's worrying after her well-being regardless. But when asked straightly what she is to him, he's laughing when he says it. But given that Jaime's approach to anything is sarcasm and humor, he's usually sincere when he does. When he describes her as his protector, it's telling that he straight up admits it and accepts it. The way he sees it, she is. And that's not what he thinks of Cersei at any point. Actually, he technically sees himself as the one who's supposed to protect her, so Brienne is already put at the opposite spectrum. But that also comes to a conclusion in the bath scene. 4. Harrenhal's bath and Jaime's confession. After they arrive at Harrenhal and are taken as prisoners by Roose Bolton, and after Jaime gets treatment for his maiming, he goes to the bathhouse in the castle to wash and finds it already occupied by Brienne. And this entire scene is a turning point in their relationship and their characters' evolutions. In order, first he sends away both their attendants, suggesting he'd rather do it with just Brienne, his protector, in the room. Then he climbs inside the same tub as Brienne. She tries to protest, but he goes in anyway. Brienne shrunk away from him. "There are other tubs. This one suits me well enough." Gingerly, he immersed himself up to his chin in the steaming water. "Have no fear, wench. Your thighs are purple and green, and I'm not interested in what you've got between them." He had to rest his right arm on the rim, since Qyburn had warned him to keep the linen dry. He could feel the tension drain from his legs, but his head spun. "If I faint, pull me out. No Lannister has ever drowned in his bath, and I don't mean to be the first." "Why should I care how you die?" At this point, we can see that having been apart for a while has made her go back to feeling awkward and distrustful of him, which is also understandable, given that they're naked together in a bath. An extremely vulnerable position. And she has issues with her looks. Anyway, what's telling here is that Jaime has absolutely no issue telling her things as, "If I faint, pull me out," as in,
Whether he knows it or not, he's seeing her as someone who will help him out if he needs it. Also, we can notice that his head is spinning, so he's already in a vulnerable position and his brain-to-mouth filter isn't working too well. Which becomes obvious in the next part, where something else interesting happens.
"Does the sight of my stump distress you so?" Jamie asked. "You ought to be pleased. I've lost the hand I killed the king with, the hand that flung the Stark boy from that tower, the hand I'd slide between my sister's thighs to make her wet." He thrust his stump at her face. "No wonder Renly died, with you guarding him." She jerked to her feet as if he'd struck her, sending a wash of hot water across the tub. Jamie caught a glimpse of the thick blonde bush at the juncture of her thighs as she climbed out. She was much hairier than his sister. Absurdly, he felt his cock stir beneath the bathwater. "Now I know I have been too long away from Cersei." He averted his eyes, troubled by his body's response. "That was unworthy," he mumbled. "I'm a maimed man, and bitter. Forgive me, wench. You protected me as well as any man could have, and better than most." Now, Jamie is obviously irked that she's back to not trusting him, especially since we saw that he hates that people never ask him why he killed Aerys, and always assume he was dishonorable without asking the question twice. And she's supposed to somehow understand him as they've been together through their time in captivity. So he gives her another fairly mean line about Renly, knowing that she will react to it, and she does, jerking to her feet as if he'd struck her. It works, and he gets a glimpse of her nakedness, which gives him an erection he's surprised that he's even having in the first place. This will be discussed more in depth later, but for now, we can say that he definitely is attracted to her, whether he likes it or not, to the point where he's troubled by it, because he's only supposed to be attracted to Cersei, and instead, he's also attracted to her. And that doesn't compute, and that is a metaphorical bucket of cold water in his face, as he realizes he was unnecessarily mean, and he asks her forgiveness, honestly, and goes back to, "You protected me better than most would have," which she hasn't asked for. But he really does see her in that light now. Brienne doesn't seem to accept that, though, and that gets him somewhat angrier. "Are you thick as a castle wall? That was an apology. I'm tired of fighting with you. What say we make a truce?" "Truces are built on trust. Would you have me trust?" "The Kingslayer, yes. The Oathbreaker who murdered poor, sad Aerys Targaryen." At that point, the dams have opened. And when she asks him if she's really supposed to trust him, he's beyond ready to inform her of why she should and why he hates being called Kingslayer / Oathbreaker. From that point on, he tells her the entire true story of how it really went, getting progressively angrier about it. But what's also important is that before he starts getting really into it, there's this. "Soiled my white cloak. I wore my gold armor that day, but..." "Gold armor?" Her voice sounded far off, faint. He floated in heat, in memory. "After Dancing Griffins lost the Battle of the Bells, Aerys exiled him. Why am I telling this absurdly ugly child?" Never mind that at the beginning he sounds even sad about it. "Soiled my white cloak and wore my gold armor," as if it was something he should be proud of. And that her voice sounds far off. He thinks that he doesn't know why he's telling her. Or better, he doesn't consciously know. But at this point, it's extremely likely that he has recognized her as a peer who believes in the same notions about knighthood he was deprived of, and who he sees as someone he can implicitly trust to keep him alive. He can share with her that story, which he never shared with anyone else. But since he's not ready to admit it to himself, he asks himself why he does it, while he's doing it.
Now, after he tells the story, he actually expects a reaction. But Brienne's speechless, as it's something she hadn't been expecting to hear. And when she doesn't immediately react, this happens. The wench looked ridiculous, clutching her towel to her meager teats, with her thick white legs sticking out underneath. Has my tale turned you speechless? Come, curse me or kiss me or call me a liar. Something. If this is true, how is it no one knows? The Knights of the Kingsguard are sworn to keep the king's secrets. Would you have me break my oath? We've established at this point, he's really just saying what's going through his head without a brain-to-mouth filter, and he straight up tells her to either curse him or kiss him, from which we can definitely deduce that some part of him wants that. Except that before she can do either, he gets angrier, discussing how no one else actually bothered to ask him why he did it, especially Ned Stark, to the point where he gets so upset he almost faints. And here we have the culmination of that entire scene. Pain shuddered through him. Ellipses. And suddenly the bathhouse was spinning. Brienne caught him before he could fall. Her arm was all goose flesh, clammy and chilled. But she was strong, and gentler than he would have thought. Gentler than Cersei, he thought as she helped him from the tub, his legs wobbly as a limp cock. Guards! He heard the wench shout. The Kingslayer! Jaime, he thought. My name is Jaime. Now, here we have another Cersei comparison. Before, he was comparing them physically, and not finding Brienne specifically wanting, just hairier. But he didn't say he didn't like it. But now, when she catches him, which is what he told her to do in the beginning of the scene, and she had sort of not openly accepted to do, except that she's doing it now, going back to her protector role, he can only think that she's stronger, strong enough to hold him up, and gentler than Cersei. And let's remember that he's really just saying what he's thinking here with any second guessing, and he likes that she's gentler than his sister. Now it doesn't matter anymore that he's been away from her too long, and he thinks nothing of the sort. But he hates that Brienne still calls him Kingslayer, to the point where he wants her to call him by his name. Same as she did during their captivity. Not by the nickname he hates, just after he bared his soul to her. Except that he doesn't know that it worked. It's made abundantly clear in Brienne's A Feast for Crows chapters, and in a couple of scenes that will be discussed later, that such a conversation did change her mind. But just after, she goes immediately back into the role she had on the road when it came to his well-being. Bring me clean garb for him, Brienne said. I'll see that he's washed and dressed. The others were all too glad to give her the task. They lifted him to his feet and sat him on a stone bench by the wall. Brienne went away to retrieve her towel and returned with a stiff brush to finish scrubbing him. Same as she did on the road, she's finishing washing him and dressing him. But this time it's not thrust on her. She volunteers for it, and no one stops her from doing it. Which suggests that she definitely also sees herself as responsible for him. It doesn't stop there. She has thicker shoulders than I do, and a bigger neck, Jaime thought. Small wonder she prefers to dress in mail. Pink was not a kind color for her either. A dozen cruel japes leaped into his head, but for once he kept them there. Best not to make her angry. He was no match for her one-handed. While she does it, he starts thinking about her looks, and he doesn't say any of the dozen cruel japes, which he also doesn't, with the same phrasing, at the end of the bear pit scene, that will be discussed later. And finally, Qyburn had brought a flask as well. What is it? Jaime demanded, when the chainless maester pressed him to drink. licorice steeped in vinegar with honey and cloves. It will give you some strength and clear your head.
Bring me the potion that grows new hands, said Jamie. That's the one I want.
Drink it, Brienne said, unsmiling. And he did.
At this point, she's nagging at him to eat and drink to get better, same as she did on the road. And he does. Again, she's put in a position where even if she isn't in charge of his health and well-being, at least she pushes him to care about it, even if he's attempting to refuse it. The moment she tells him to do it, he does it. At this point, they established a deeper connection because he's told her his most guarded secret, and she knows about everything there is to know about him. Almost. And then Roos Bolton frees him, but not her, and implies that if her ransom isn't enough, he will leave her to the bandits who kidnapped them first. Jaime, at this point, leaves, figuring he'll finally go back to Cersei in King's Landing and leave everything behind. But it doesn't go quite like that.